you very much for coming out to the
pleasure
to sit with the seagulls and talk to us about this. So could you tell us, perhaps start by just telling us how you ended up going to Greenham? What was your story of getting there?
Well, my involvement with Greenham was through the Fallout Marching Band, which was my runaway and joined the circus when I was a bad teenager. And that was an anti-nuclear street protest band based in London. And there was a whole sort of community of people to whom I was very drawn as a disenfranchised 15-year-old. So I moved to the other side of London and became part of that and all that meant. And Greenham was part of that. So for me, Greenham wasn't the main focus. Greenham was sort of a radical experience that took me from a very different sort of life, and it was very much part of being with the Fallout Marching Band.
Mm. Can you tell us more about the band? They sounded really interesting.
Yeah, no, they're fantastic. And one of the most thrilling thing about Fallout Marching Band is that we still meet and we still play.
Really?
With subsequent generations now. So my kids have played with them, and we meet at WOMED once a year and do all of the excuse me, all of the Brexit, anti-Trump, climate change type marches in London. So it still exists as one of the street bands.
How did you find out about them at the time?
It was one of those just weird coincidence things, really. I was a schoolgirl. I was 15, and I was on the tube in London doing some journey that didn't mean anything, and I saw a busker who somehow kind of, I don't know, I fell in love with a busker. It was a woman called Maddie, and she was very colourful, and I hadn't seen anything like that. She was young, and she was playing the flute, and there was just something about her that I couldn't let go of from my dull suburban teenage, not very happy at home existence. Mm. And I couldn't get on the tube. I really wanted to talk to her, but I was cripplingly shy. Aww. And I didn't know what to talk to her about, because she was just a busker. She didn't have anything to do with me. Anyway, I ended up talking to her in some way, and she was very lovely and said that she was playing in a band and I should come along and meet at Covent Garden and say hello. And so, of course, I did. And then just kind of gradually, I was the mascot kid hang-along.
Oh, that's really nice.
So, yeah, it was a very random happening, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did that then involve you going to Greenham? Did they all go and you went with them?
Yeah, we went to Faz Lane, we went to Greenham. Fallout Band is not a female band, you know, it's a mixed band. So we went, I can't remember if we went as the Fallout Band on an occasion that wasn't women only, or if it was the women from the Fallout Band being part of a Greenham band. I can't honestly remember which it is.
Yeah.
But that was, it was through the older women that I knew who were part of that movement.
Yeah.
And I never lived there. I went there, I sometimes stayed a night. Lots of memories of being terrified of hitching, because you still hitched everywhere then.
Right.
And hitching to Greenham.
How old would you have been when you were doing that then?
16.
That's quite young, isn't it?
I guess. Yeah, now, as the mother of a 16-year-old, seems terribly young, but my kids seem terribly different as well.
And why was hitching the
because you thing? Would because there were lots of people who were very antagonistic, who quite enjoyed picking people up in order to give them a really hard time.
Really?
Or were just, you know,
because you were going to Greenham.
Yeah, and because it was obvious from what you looked like that you were going to Greenham. That's or that you just end up having, you know, it's like when you're sat with someone and you suddenly realise that you're going to have a really hideous Brexit conversation, and you know that it's not going to be one of those easy in your bubble ones, that it's going to be one of those take you out your bubble ones.
Mm.
And being 16 and not really having a clue about the sort of bigger politics, I knew that anyone would be able to take me down and I would sound stupid. Because I didn't really, you know, it was very kind of gut feeling stuff. So that was always intimidating.
Would you be with another woman who would help with that argument, or would you
not necessarily? Yeah, I would hit for my own.
Gosh, that does sound really intimidating. What was it like turning up to Greenham on your own?
Well, I think I probably didn't mostly go on my own. I would have gone because there was an action that we were supporting, and so that would have been in a group. But there were times when, you know, I then needed to do things like go back to school.
Yeah.
Not that lasted very long, school, but there was a time.
Mm. How did it change you to be doing all this and then going back into that school life and that suburban life that you're talking about? Was that?
It made it feel ridiculous and pointless and untenable, and I didn't stay in that world for very long. I'd moved out by the time I was 16, so it was part of that process.
Yeah. So, what are your sort of immediate memories? If you say Greenham, what are the things that pop into your? What are the first things that come to your head?
I remember finding quite a lot of the women quite intimidating because they were very bright. They were older than me. They all knew what they were talking about, and I did feel like an idiot child.
Mm.
So there was always that sort of. But then I think I spent most of my teens feeling like I was playing with the grown-ups and having to pretend to be one and not really feeling like one.
Yeah.
So it was definitely an extension of that. But you're also very drawn to those situations because they're all very... you know, very appealing and attractive and charismatic, and that's who you're drawn to. They're your significant adults. So that's, and you feel all those things particularly strongly when you're that sort of age, I guess. Mm. It was very exciting, and it was very, you know, sort of actions in the woods, crawling through the trees with a pair of bolt cutters is about as exciting as you get. And I was very conscious at the time how kind of cops and robbers fun that was.
Really?
And obviously it was about size of... important issues, but a lot of the experience for me at that age was kind of quite high octane fear and fun, really.
Yeah, a lot of people listening to this probably won't know. I've done that. I haven't done that. So can you talk us?
I'm glad your mum didn't give you a pair of bolt cutters when you were
five or whatever. Some women who did give their children bolt cutters and their children got arrested. Another story, but. My mum just took me to the nice, safe daytime actions.
Mm.
Could you talk us through the process of when you say that kind of cops and robbers scenario, how would that be from sort of roughly beginning to end? What would that have entailed?
Well, it felt to me, I mean, there was a constant aim was to get inside the base, was to broach the base. That felt incredibly important and was the point of quite a lot of... a lot of actions, and I was definitely up for the daring do's. Of course, there was a lot of, you know, encircling the base and holding hands and non-violent and sitting in front of trucks and all of that as well. But there did feel like a sense of urgency of broaching the base and sort of showing that it wasn't.
Being a bit more direct.
Yeah, that you could, that it didn't have to be a permanent wall and, you know, the symbolism of what that meant. And we did get inside once and climb up on something and get very arrested by lots of American soldiers and all that.
How was that? How were they with you?
Very similar to all the circumstances of being on demonstrations in London and being arrested, you know, it didn't feel hugely different. Lots of men trying to be very disengaged and not really make eye contact with the people that they're
manhandling.
Yeah. But at the time as well, I think there was much more of a... it felt a lot more... in the 80s, it felt to me like there was a very cut and dried. The police were bad, you know. Right. They were, you know, everyone was using language like the pigs, and coming from a culture of squatting and being also very involved in the South African embassy demonstrations, and of course there'd been the miners' march and all of that, and it was a very anti-authoritarian time. And so it was easier, in a way, I think, to simplify that. And one's response is, you know, just as they probably did the same of kind of a load of woolly-headed, muddy dykes in their eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think probably when you read about women who are older... And that obviously there were lots and lots of older women at Greenham, and there, I think they probably had a more, a less simplistic relationship with those people and those.
Mm.
You know, I know there were people who had, you know, brothers who were in the armed forces or.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just more life experience to know that, you know. All sorts of journeys take you to different places, and it doesn't necessarily make anyone good, bad, or. But I think I had a much more simplistic. It was all much clearer to me when I was 16. It was terribly obvious.
Things are about that when you're 16, aren't they? You talked about the women being intimidating, as well as it being an alluring situation to be with them. Were any of them? Was that sort of purely through the feeling one has at 16 of being inferior to things but also wanting them? Or was it, did any of them make the effort to be friendly? Or do you think they were busy being in the
I don't mean it in a critical way at all. I mean, you know, you were there, a lot of the women, you know, were living really through extreme times and extreme relationships. And, you know, we'd come up as sort of day trippers, really. I would mostly have been interacting with the women that I went with and just kind of watching everyone else. I didn't make new contacts or friends there. I had sort of enough on my plate, just sort of being there and getting on with
sense.
It, really.
Did you go to particular gates, do you remember?
I was trying to remember that. I remember the feel of how very different they were.
Oh, really?
But I can't remember which was which.
That's okay. What were the feelings like that were different? What was sort of...
Well, they were sort of feelings of... I think I was there early enough that there was a time when there was only one gate that was women only.
Oh, really?
And then it was all women only. So that had a very different... there was a lot of politics, of Greenham politics being talked about all the time that I really didn't understand, but I was very conscious of.
What were the sort of buzzwords around that then that you associate with that?
I don't think I've got any, really. It was just... I was just aware that it was...
There were rules or...
No, not
ideas.
So much that there were rules, but that, you know, just lots of business and lots of getting on with and lots of, you know, people would get fractious, obviously, and there would be dramas and there would be people having their benders ripped down and there would be people getting ill and there'd be people, you know, stuff happened all the time. There was stuff happening always. So it was just very, quite full on.
Yeah, it sounds full on. It sounds very full on. And did you take the band play there? Did you take music to them? Because a lot of the Green Women talk about music being, or song particularly, being a really big part of.
Yeah.
And how was that received?
Well, I remember that, you know, there were Greenham songs, and we would also sing and play those. I don't think there was particularly a... I mean, there wasn't a sense of bringing music to Greenham. There was more a sense of joining in with music at Greenham.
Oh, nice.
No, there was lots of music happening.
Yeah. Were people quite pleased to see if you had an instrument? Because there wasn't many instruments, from what I understand. It was mostly voice.
Yeah, it was mostly voice. I mean, the band things would have been on Action Day, big Action Days, where lots and lots of people would have been there. It wasn't so much a sitting around the campfire thing, musically. That's not...
What happened around the campfires, then?
Planning and talking and cooking and all the things that happen around campfires. But I guess always with the sort of, you know, looking over your shoulder, it's not camping in the normal sense of the word. So,
Was there a sense of being that there might be danger?
All the time. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Because it wasn't just from the base. You know, the police were constantly trying to clear the camps. It wasn't just responding to specific actions. And there was also antagonism from the town and from people that, you know, felt aggressively offended by the whole notion of it. And I think quite a lot of that was how pejorative the... you know, the notion of lesbians was in that. You know, it was a very new thing and it was very radical. You know, if you were a lesbian and you talked about it, then you were... It was radicalising. No, because it... it, you know, mostly been used as an insult, really. Mm. You know, it was still... It was a very... I think it's always been harder to be a gay woman than a gay man. Mm. It's always been seen as unattractive and dysfunctional and sort of ugly, isn't it? You know, with the amount of pressure there is on women and appearance and, you know, historically forever and ever and ever, and that's somehow that the sort of the threatening notion of lesbianism is so tied in with that.
So it was a radical act to just even say it as a neutral fact about yourself.
Yeah, so a lot of the reporting and the talk about it and the anger about it use that as a sort of fundamental tool, I suppose, in some way that I didn't really understand at the time, but I was very conscious of. That's, I very much remember that.
And people were actually would come to the camp to be angry with you about it, sort of thing.
Yeah, I got the impression that happened quite a lot, really.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, as soon as you went off the camp, and it was, you know, it's like when you've been at a festival for a long time, and then you're leaving on the way home and you go to a service station and the world looks so weird.
Yeah.
And the whole world looked like that all the time when you were at Greenham.
And the service station looks at you and goes, oh, they've come from that bloody festival. Yeah. Which is,
you feel like
not
you stick out a mile, you're so easy to spot.
Yeah.
And you've just come from somewhere where you just feel completely ordinary.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And how long did you sort of carry on visiting for?
Not that long, really. It was just that time in my life. It was between sort of 16 and 18, and then politics stayed more in London, I think, after that. And then by the time I was 22, I moved out of London.
Do you feel like any of the experiences or anything about Greenham has had legacy in your own life?
Well, undoubtedly what Greenham represents, but it was, there were many, it was that time in my life made me, of course, was absolutely formative, and it was an essential part of that. I can't pull out something that was unique to the Greenham experience. It was part of who I was and who I wanted to be with, and the politics of the time, and that was very fundamental.
How did your family feel about you being there? Did you have?
Well, what you mean, my parents?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah. I think my father just thought it was silly. He's a man of facts and information and science, and was able and was infuriating to try and have an argument with if you were someone who operated in, you know, as an emotional 16-year-old who didn't actually have a lot of facts but could sort of see, knew what you felt and knew who you wanted to be with, and was sort of gradually acquiring them. So I tended to avoid having those conversations because I didn't feel strong enough, I suppose, in that environment. When it's just suddenly you back home in the parental home, you haven't got the strength of your gang with you.
No.
You're not surrounded by this world that you've just decided to be part of, and you feel a little bit kind of naked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did your mum relate to those conversations, or did you talk about it with her at all, or? Because they must have had strong views about you not living at home anymore, weren't they?
Yes, and I think that was the thing, was that there was so much else going on between me and my parents that Greenham was absolutely the least of it.
The least of their worries.
Absolutely. You know.
Did you have friends from that old life who were a bit like, wow, everything you're doing is really cool? Or were they like, everything you're doing is...
No, I sort of did that that thing of completely stopping one life and starting another.
Really?
And it took a long time before... I mean, I do now still have a couple of friends from school who are very dear to me, but I completely fell away from them at the time because they were living very different lives, and I was probably quite a bad friend, you know. I just sort of saw this other world and went for it, and they didn't really fit with it.
Yeah.
And it took a while before, you know, we sort of re-found each other.
What was it about, this is probably quite a difficult question because so much of what we're saying is about how something felt rather than something worked out in vocabulary at the time. But looking back at it now, what do you think it was about that other world, what that represented, that's so Maddie and you know, and that moment where you saw her and all that stuff? Like, what was that world? What were the things about that world that drew you, that had such meaning for you, that you knew it was the right place for you?
It is mostly about feelings, and it is difficult to... And I'm not sure that I've ever really kind of thought about that question. But oddly, I was thinking about it when I was cycling over, of what the difference between those worlds are. And I think that the world of my family and their friends' family, they were very self-absorbed. And they were very to do with, you know, friendships, but fundamentally about your nuclear family, funny choice of a word, but experience and those, you know, everything was about your family and it wasn't very outward looking, and I think it wasn't very community. I didn't have a strong, looking back, there wasn't a strong sense of community. I didn't go to school particularly near where we lived. I didn't, I think we had one or two friends on the street, but there wasn't a big community sense. Mm. And I think possibly that was one of the most attractive things, was the whole world of that. Similar, I suppose, to when you leave home, you know, the common experience of going to uni and suddenly finding that you've got this whole society that you've got access to, and that you may or may not have things in common with, and that you can explore, and that that's incredibly exciting. But it was more than just that. It was about what people could achieve when being together, and just how important that felt, and how interesting that felt, and how much more interesting than just seeing your life in isolation, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's remained something that's incredibly important to me. So that, but I don't know if that gave me that, or if that's what I was looking for, and so I would have found it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know, really.
The way you described it really sounded like it was in you, and you recognised how to unlock it when you saw the key, in a sense. It
felt yeah. Like yes.
You knew what you needed, and it was there.
Yes.
Which is pretty cool.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. I was just wondering about, I think I didn't spend as long as I meant to talking to you about the difference in the parts of Greenham, but you mentioned that some of them were women only. And then obviously it all was, but that was a different feeling. So what was different about the women-only aspect of it, do you think? What did that do for the, either you or for the situation?
I couldn't talk for the situation. I wasn't there enough. I was too much of a spectator. It would feel like I haven't really got a right to have an opinion about that.
But in terms of how you picked it up as a feeling, perhaps you could describe that. Like, why was it different, do you think? Did it feel different?
I guess it just felt like a very interesting idea, and it was very around in politics at the time. It felt like the more, for instance, where I was living on a road called Villa Road, which was in Brixton, and it was a street of squats in the early 80s, and that politics was very, very much around in the early 80s. I mean, probably had been way before then, but obviously I was only just sort of emerging into the world, and so I was taking it on. They felt like new ideas in as much as how unaccepted they were and how much they were challenged. So that made them feel new, but they probably had been unaccepted and challenged for 50 years before that.
Time memorial.
Yeah. But I know within the house there was the women only house, and there were there would be sometimes you go to gigs and it would be women only, and I just remember it being just a massive issue, because obviously it tended to draw the women who were more radicalised and therefore a little bit more intimidating.
Yeah, sure.
And I was very very unformed sexuality at that point, so I didn't really know where I fitted in all of that, and was busy kind of spectating it all. And intimidating, charismatic women are also very attractive, but very intimidating. So it was all of that. It was all of that. So I guess the gates was all part of that kind of awareness and that feeling that they were... that the not women only gates were much more likely to have the strong grandmother characters, and there were a lot of very proud older women to whom I really wasn't drawn, because that wasn't what you look for when you've just left home and you're 16. You're looking at the young people on the whole. So I saw it all through that sort of slightly dysfunctional filter.
So was the woman-only space, did it feel younger to you?
I've been making stuff up at this point. I really don't have a memory of that, and I don't want to make stuff up.
No, that's absolutely fine.
I don't really remember much more detail than than I've said.
It's really interesting. It's lovely. I'm interested in that in the squatted road as well. Actually, I'm just fascinated that because it sounds like there's so many parts. Because we often see green as being so unique. And people, and lots of women, it's very unique, and lots of women, it was a unique thing in their life. They hadn't been part of doing anything like
right.
it. And for you, what's really interesting about your interview, and really different to the
It was
ones,
just an extension.
Is that, yeah, you were in the middle of all of... Mm. It was one of the many prongs of that, wasn't it? So I suppose... And do you feel like all of that is it turns out it's changed how you live in general, and it's part of how you have conducted yourself and grown yourself as an adult? Or do you feel like it's sort of dropped away now? And like if you were going to a later Greenham now, which one would you be drawn to, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would really enjoy the fact that I had access to both, I think.
Yeah. Strong grandmother stuff and not being as intimidated by the radical stuff.
Yeah.
Person. I just wondered how that came out other than the music. Do you get involved in the art there?
No, not particularly. I was, I think all of that side of my life wasn't particularly active at that time. Mm. I'd been very into all of that at school, but I was so busy just finding my feet and existing in this world and I've always been very drawn to music and musicians, but I'm no musician. So I was always, it was definitely part of feeling a bit inadequate. You know, it was definitely a kind of a hanger-on. I didn't ever played anything quite well enough. And
what did you play?
I played... Well, in the early days, I had a flute, and I played the flute in the band because I needed something that you could walk along with. And I played the cello a bit at school, and it really wasn't practical.
Not That's not walk-alongable, is it?
It's not, no.
When did you rediscover your artistic self, then, in the process of all this?
Well, I went to...
Reclaim it.
It wasn't until I did a found... I mean, it wasn't that long. It felt like a long time then. I did a foundation course, so I decided to go to art school, and I guess I was 22. So now that feels like no time at all. That was, what, 6 years. But in comparison to... 6 years feels like a long time when you're a teenager.
Huge.
Going into early adulthood. And I know I certainly, amongst all of the other people on the foundation who were mostly 18 and coming straight from school, I felt completely different. And the same at coming down to Falmouth to art school at 23. And lots of people were, again, 18, because not everyone even does a foundation. Sometimes you just go straight.
Period of time with all those radicalising prongs, all those different aspects of your life that you've been through, did that sort of separate you from people when you re-entered things like art school and all sort of traditional settings?
I mean, less so in London, because London was London, and so nothing, everything sort of ran parallel to that, and there was a sort of London energy. I was very, very conscious of it when I came down to Falmouth, that it was just missing, like...
Yeah.
Where's nobody? It was like the course had been sort of self-selecting by people who wanted to get away from everything. Like, people were drawn to Falmouth because they wanted a quiet life and to wander by the beach and paint landscapes. And I really didn't feel like that then. I'd stay for a second longer than my degree, because I felt like such a Londoner. I wanted to get out of London. That's why I went to Falmouth. It had a good reputation, and I didn't. And I wanted to explore living somewhere else, and that was really exciting. But it never crossed my mind I wouldn't be back. I didn't even know if I'd managed 3 years.
And yet you're here still.
And here I am. I know, you get stuck, don't you? And now I go back to London, and I really don't feel like I belong there at all.
Really?
No, I don't.
That's
like
so
it at all.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what changed your mind when you were here? Did you find other radical elements, or did they become less important to you, or...?
Well, you do inevitably, you know, get busy with your you know, life comes upon you, doesn't it? And there is a, you know, a big chunk when you're, because I met Alan, my husband, when I was at art school, and we've been together for 30 years now, and we had 3 kids, and that is quite distracting.
Yes, that is distracting. Yeah. And did he want to settle down here, or did you just feel like a better place to have
He'd
children?
Already been living here. He moved when he was 17 from London. He'd come to the boat building school, and
right.
And then he was a bit older than me, so he'd been here for quite a long time. Yeah.
How did your radical nature fit with going into a basic sort of heteronormative or a heterosexual sort of marriage after everything that you'd been experiencing? A more traditional setup, I suppose, is what I mean.
Well, it wasn't a more traditional setup for a long time. I mean, we were just, you know, going out. We were going out for about 7 years in a sort of, before we had kids. You know, it wasn't like
I suddenly settled down.
You know, got married and moved into a 2-bed semi. So it was a gradual.
Was he sort of on the same page as you politically? Is that part what
yes.
you
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he was active in Friends of the Earth and doing that sort of stuff down here.
Mm.
But, you know, then you do get very... The sort of lives that we were living in sort of boats and caravans are very time-consuming, and you do become more self-absorbed, you know, and I hear my youthful critical voice of the self-absorbedness of my family and think, yeah, and then I did exactly that. It is what you tend to do in that sort of middle chunk of your life. And there's quite a big bit of me that feels that was culpable, really, now, where we're at. I feel like a lot of people took their eye off the ball.
It's difficult if you've got to keep your eye on your children, though. Like, you'd have been just as culpable if anything had happened to them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And the ball's still in the air, I think.
I think we could safely say.
So we can all look at it again. Do you think it's important that, I'm going to say Greenham, but Greenham as a representation for all of this radicalised politics or more connective, more community-based politics, do you think it's important that Greenham as part of that is handed on to subsequent generations? Does it matter if it's forgotten?
Yeah, no, of course it matters. It's terrifically important. It's very hard to feel, and I think it just gets harder and harder to feel as an individual that you can have an impact. And I think those politics are more important than ever.
Did Greenham show that you could have an impact? Is that one of those that's important about it?
Yeah, no, it definitely had an impact. It definitely... Yes, I imagine it was for a lot of women, it was the equivalent of me meeting Maddie in the tube. It was a hugely radicalising, fundamental experience that changed their lives.
Mm.
Yeah, no, it was an extraordinary, it was was an extraordinary time, and it's, I mean, I actually haven't particularly come across people. It just shows the sheltered world I live in, that who go, what's Greenham? That's kind of shocking to hear. Just shows we continue living in our bubbles.
It's good though, your bubble sounds really nice. If everyone knows about Greenham in your bubble, that sounds great.
But it also, I mean, I'm not, I don't talk about the past very much. Hmm. It's not something that I talk about. You know, my kids may well go, oh, were you at Greenham, Mum? It's not like tales of Greenham abound at the breakfast table.
But they know what it was. You know,
I tend to sort of live in the moment and in the now and with the things that we're doing, and I don't, I'm not a big anecdote-y person.
Yeah.
So in that regard, not that I've got any, you know, particularly cutting edge anecdotes, but just the fact of it, it doesn't want to just wash into the soil.
Is there anything that you thought I might ask you, or you were expecting me to ask that I haven't? No. Anything that you'd have liked to talk about that you haven't had a chance to? Anything you really want the people of the future to know?
God, the weight of responsibility.
No, anything that you would like to have covered?
No, sorry.
That's all right. It's not a bad or a good. It's great. It's been really nice to talk to you, Jude.
It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much. So what photos have you got?
Very few, but that was that was being on one of the actions in outside Greenham.
Oh God, look at all the colours. Sort of rainbow headdresses. Is that you?
And that's me, little me.
So little you. So yeah. Who are the other women?
That's Ruth, that's Mary, and that's Sally.
And is this the band? This is all you playing your instruments?
Yeah.
Had you made all your costumes?
So,
as well?
You know, I can only see women there, so I think it was the women of the Fallout band.
I think you're right, going to do...
Either that or it's a massive coincidence, and that looks pretty women-only. That's at one of the gates.
Oh, pretty. Again, like rainbow balloons in these really pastel colours.
It's beautiful.
It looks cold, though. So in this one, you look like you're wearing coats and hats, and in this one, you're all wearing rain gear over your instruments.
Yeah. I mean, rain and mud was a constant...
Was it?
Yeah.
So a bit like Glastonbury, but without all of the beer. Had you made your own costumes for this? Because these are really beautiful head, like rainbow headdress things. So cool.
Yeah, no, that was fun.
And you've all come on the bus that's behind, is that?
Or someone did. I mean, I don't know. No, I mean, that was probably a coach load of people from somewhere else. I don't think we ever came on a coach from anywhere.
Did you always kind of hitch, do you reckon, pretty much, or...?
Yeah, or someone had a car and we'd all be in a car, or...
Those are lovely, thank you. Can we photograph them?
Oh, sure, of course.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
If that's OK, that'd be lovely. What was the last one? I think that's that one. Is it a kite?
No, it's a big banner. It's a big banner.
What's it say underneath?
That's what I was just trying to...
Weird thing about this is it does have there's lots of banners in this picture of all different heights, which is what it's like looking out over a Glastonbury crowd when you're watching it.
It could be WOMAD, Walk for Life.
But of course, it's sort of the sanitised version to do it at a festival, isn't it?
See, I wonder if that was I think there were like marches that ended up at Greenham or started at Greenham. And I remember the Walk for Life just as a phrase, and I can, because obviously I'm to read it through, and that says Greenham, but I can't remember.
It started with women walking, a mixed group, but mostly women walking from Wales, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then there were star marches, I think, and stuff that people told me about. That. Mm. I think are geographic.
And we did we went with the band in the summer that I was 15. We went from Frankfurt to Sicily on bicycles with the band. Really was hard to go back to school after that.
Oh my God, yeah.
And there was a big peace rally in Vienna that we went on, and that was so it's just it was absolutely what I was doing at the time.
Wow.
Completely. It was so Greenham was just another
part of it. Going all over the world to do it is amazing. What was that? Where did you stay?
All sorts of different places. I remember staying in Venice, and we were put up by some member of the Communist Party on an island.
Oh,
it was
my God.
Bonkers in some sort of commune, and we did lots of camping and that sort of thing.
It sounds great. Did you ever have did you have like love affairs or fallouts, or how did the band kind of get on a day-to-day?
Definitely fallouts.
Definitely fallouts.
Oh yeah, all of that. And meetings, my God, the meetings.
What were the meetings like? What does that mean?
Just everything required a meeting. Required a meeting, and there were some very strong personalities, and they went on for bloody ever.
To garner consent?
Because everything was non-hierarchical and anarchistic, and nobody could actually just make a decision, and there were no leaders, so everything required a meeting.
Oh, God. It sounds wonderful and terrible at the same time. Like, women have talked about Greenham as well. That's how they organise there, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, no, meetings were... I know, because meetings sound now like bureaucracy and local government and doing things properly, but my memory of meetings in the 80s was absolutely different.
What were they like for the...
They were just... they lasted for a very long time, and everyone had very strong feelings, and usually at some point somebody would walk out. And I was definitely not someone who'd ever talk at a meeting, which did kind of make them seem even longer.
Was there not?
Yeah.
And you weren't encouraged? There wasn't sort of, we haven't heard from you, comrade, you must tell us your feelings?
Oh, no, I mean, I'd have died under the nearest anything. no, but I mean, it was just the way that everything was done. Everything that we did, that was, you know, there was no other way of making decisions and choices. So they'd all be, you know, be different according to whether it was a house meeting because the four of you in the house, or if it was a fallout band meeting, in which case there'd be 35 people, or if it was a Greenham meeting, or if it... So, yeah, I can't generalise, but there were definitely, there were quite a lot of meetings.
And did you vote to get a final decision, or was it literally just talked and talked and talked until...
I don't remember voting particularly. No.
I think that's almost seen as a shortcut, isn't it, a little bit?
Yeah.
In the process of really discussing it.
I mean, I still don't know. I mean, how else do you organise things? You have to get together and talk about it, don't you?
Yeah.
But obviously there are lots of shortcuts. And you have to learn to structure things in a way that means that you're more efficient and you actually get things done.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because otherwise you don't get things done, you just have meetings and that's pointless.
Yeah. That's a real time energy suck, isn't it, on people? Mm. When did you stop being with the band? When was that period of your life?
Well, when I moved out of London.
So it was...
Yeah.
Although, as you say, you still see them.
Yeah, but there was a huge sort of 15, 20-year gap.
Oh, really?
Between that and everyone going and having their big middle section of their lives, and then having the urge to kind of reform, and that was WOMAD.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
That's
playing on the procession at WOMAD, and that happens every year now, so there's a kind of a reunion every year.
Oh.
You know, and the band's changed, and, you know, some people we've lost because they've died, and other people, you know, now people's kids come and...
Do your kids go?
Yeah.
That's really nice. I can imagine them loving that.